You know ID, ID in the D in the town all day. ID, ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID, ID in the D in the town all day. ID, ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 209 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are joined this week by the two-time Pelton Cast MVP. The listener has spoken. The vote that was put together by the listener, Kevin Calabro, at big_paper_daddy. It was closer this year than 2019. I made a run at it, but for the second consecutive year, the fabulous Cousin Katie is your choice as PeltonCast MVP, and naturally, she joins us this week.
That's right, chumps, I'm back.
The good news is, because of the pandemic, you can't taunt us with a t-shirt in person like you did last year.
No, but I would like to note that arriving in your mailbox sometime this week or next,
are you kidding me?
There will be not a t-shirt, but a framed photo of the vote, and it will say on the bottom, let's see if I can get this quote, because I read this quote, shouts to big_paper_daddy for this quote, where he said, "I was as nerdy as Kevin, but as cool as Tristan." And so that's going to be on the bottom of the that you guys can hang on your walls where you do the Pelton Cast. But I just pictured Tristan reading that I was as cool as him, and him being just so sad. So,
well, I mean, we should also go through the full results here. So 35%. For Katie, 31% for me, 19% for Mrs. Fantasy Genius, who won the play-in tournament, and coming in last with 15%, Tristan. Do you have some thoughts?
Thanks, Kevin. I think everyone knows exactly what the circumstances are right now in my decision to stop podcasting on the Pelton Cast. That doesn't mean I'm never going to podcast somewhere else. You know, if Dunked On needs a new co-host, or when I inevitably get hired by The Athletic. But I've talked with all my confidants, my family, not either of you, of course, my friends. I've even talked to Jan yesterday and today, and I'm very solid on my decision to not podcast on the Pelton Cast.
What did Jan have to say about this?
The reason being, I've heard a lot of speculation on my reason for not podcasting, but I've always stressed to the media, to the 441 followers I have on Twitter, that when I lose the sense of motivation and the sense to improve myself as a podcaster, that it's time for me to move on from podcasting. You know, I think I've achieved a lot in my short career, if you want to call it short.
Short.
And honestly, I think you people don't deserve me. I've always said I would never let you guys run me out of the podcasting game. Don't think I'm letting you do that. It's going to be tough, but I'm very happy with my decision and my ability to make this decision. So thank you. And I hopefully and hope so. Thank you. And hopefully I don't see too many of you guys in the future. Now, you can go somewhere else and get yourself a podcast. So thanks. And I'm unwilling to answer any of the off-the-wall questions you might have. Goodbye.
Were you suspended by David Stern?
Wow.
No, he actually did leave. Oh, dear.
Did he drop off the call?
This is incredible commitment to the bet, I gotta say. He actually did leave the call.
He left the call? Oh, God.
All right, so let's remember some years.
But I don't know anything about the years. See, this is a problem, as Tristan actually provides very good color commentary to this podcast. Without him, it's going to be...
I legitimately have no idea how long this is going to go on before he comes back.
We're going to be deficient.
Before he sends the fax that says, I'm back.
I knew he was mad. I didn't know he was that mad. I also want to know what Jan said.
I don't think that he actually talked to her about it. That was he was just doing Michael Jordan's retirement speech.
No, I understand, okay. But I would be curious. Would Jan say, "Yeah, you should stop that stupid podcasting," or would she should say, "Keep it up"? I don't know.
It's going on a long time. A
lot of silence here.
I guess we got to get into what we're drinking.
Oh, yeah. So I'm drinking water.
Oh, classic.
I had an emergency earlier today.
That's quite exciting. I have from our friends at Elysian Brewing in Seattle. He thinks it's cashmere hazy IPA. Their description to this: the sun was on its last sliver of light, casting a rich haze onto the scene. There was a scent in the air that could only be described as oats and juice. Breakfast, she mumbled. There was a lot to take in. She reached for a ripe pineapple that seemed intentionally placed on the desk. Why is this here? Her eyes darted across the collection of items on display, fruit in hand. A large painting of an orchard hung proudly behind the desk, faded and dusty with time. A photo of what looked to be a pet snake was crookedly placed beside the painting, with a dainty gold plate beneath it that read, Clementine. She smirked. The floor creaked behind her. The office was showing its age. Nice sweater, said the voice, somewhat hesitantly. Her expression was unmoved. She didn't even look back to see who it was as her sharp gaze was on Clementine. Thanks. It's cashmere.
Wow.
So apparently cashmere is a hop. I didn't know that. The cashmere in Simcoe hops here.
Is it?
With notes of pineapple, sweet orchard fruit, and clementine orange.
Huh.
Little femme fatale vibe here on the bottle.
You might have said this in the entire thing you were just reading, but is cashmere from Kashmir? Kashmir, Washington?
No, it has nothing to do with the city of Kashmir, sadly.
Oh, darn. That would have been exciting.
This does take me back because we're going to talk in a second here about the 1996 NBA Finals after The Last Dance featured them. And during the 1996 NBA Finals, my eighth grade class, we were doing film noir movies. Like, we made our own movie, was our final project in English class, is a film noir.
Hmm.
So there you go. All right. Well, first up, a toast to the UW football program for achieving the highest four-year academic progress rate, an APR of 999 ever by an FBS football program. A great testament to Coach Pete on his way in out, not into retirement, I guess, into whatever it is he's doing now.
He's isolating away from everyone else somewhere peacefully.
Probably so, actually, yes. It was a good time to step away from coaching, yeah. Things considered.
Cheers to Coach Pete.
We're also this week, and hopefully this will draw Tristan out of retirement wearing the 4-5. We're pouring one out for Il Corvo.
Oh, God.
Whose owner announced on Instagram last week that it would not be reopening when restaurants in the Seattle area are able to reopen as we move to phase two of that plan in Washington. Continue to operate Il Nido in West Seattle, which is right now functioning is kind of a dry goods store where they're selling pasta and pasta sauce, and then will return to serving pasta regularly when that is possible.
This is just so sad. You know, an iconic location, storefront, experience. Like, you can't have that experience anymore. But not just because they're gone, just that it wouldn't work, given how things are now. And it's very sad.
Yeah, we covered Il Corvo on the Pelton cast when all of us went there back in, I want to say, June 2018. I'll have to look that up.
I will miss the kale salad. Delicious. And anytime they had a pasta with chanterelles, delicious. You, of course, would have hated that.
Oh, yeah. I will not miss that, as it turns out.
No mushrooms. But I have bought their dry goods, pasta, and sauces. I, of course, haven't left my house.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
But prior to this, Il Corvo used to sell the pastas and the sauces just in their refrigerator case up front. When you went in to get your meal, your sit-down meal, you could get some to take home. And so
was
I would do
that. Was that a classic sneak?
I mean, I never used it as a sneak. I would always eat and then buy more pasta to take home for later. But when you cook, it's not that hard when you have the sauce and you have the pasta. You can basically make yourself an Il Corvo, you know, meal.
There you go.
So that they're still doing that, there's some light at the end of the tunnel. You can experience it in just a little portion of it. So,
I mean, the sad reality is there's going to be a lot more announcements like this in the weeks and months to come as we reckon with the economic fallout from, you know, people, these shelter-in-place order. So, you know, this, again, makes it all the more imperative that to the extent we can, that we continue to support local restaurants and businesses to, you know, try to keep our favorites operating.
Yes.
All right. Also in sad news this week, we lost one of the great comedians in Jerry Stiller, who has a specific connection to this podcast because, of course, we haven't done it in a while, but the Airing of Grievances segment features Jerry Stiller's classic rant is Frank Costanza from Seinfeld from the Festivus episode.
Yes, and the great family memory of airing our grievances with each other.
Much better memory than the feats of strength. Which is not my favorite ever. I can't believe this isn't even going to draw you out, Tristan. You're not even going to talk about Airing of Grievances.
He's back. We can see him, right?
I got a lot of problems with you people.
Oh, there we go. There he is.
Hello! Oh, 45 on my chest. It'll be back to 23 by the end of this podcast. Don't worry.
45 and 23. What are you drinking?
I was drinking, since we are talking about the Portland Trailblazers for the first time ever on Let's Remember Some Years, from our good friends at Portland, or our friends at Portland Cider Company, a pineapple rosé.
Huh.
But I've finished that, and I have moved on to a cool frosty right here.
There you go.
How sugary is a pineapple rosé?
Quite.
Okay, so I alluded to...
I came back on, and Kevin was doing this, like...
the illusion
bottle?
I was
like, he's reading something now. I was like, this podcast changed so much in the minute I was gone.
It actually became NPR.
It sounded really NPR-ish.
And her name was Clementine. I was just like, what the fuck?
I really did not expect that description to be as long as it was when I started it. And then it just kept going.
I blacked out during it, so...
But it'll help explain when you see the...
No idea what you were talking about.
When I post the bottle on Instagram, it'll make more sense, I think.
Is the bottle just a copy of Moby Dick? Like,
the bottle has it's got like a cartoon femme fatale, and then whoever the, I guess the detective is, who is saying, nice sweater. So there you go.
All right.
Should we talk about the 1996 NBA Finals? We're not remembering 1996, but I would argue that the Sonics had their greatest moment in the sun in probably at least 12 years, being featured at the end of Episode 8 of The Last Dance as they looked back on the 1996 NBA Finals. Not Sean Kemp, actually, who was only mentioned one time as Gary Payton's alley-oop partner, or pick-and-roll partner.
All he could do, I guess.
No mention of the fact that he was the best player on the court during the 1996 NBA Finals. What were your other takeaways from that segment?
The laughing.
Oh, it was very painful.
It's like you go into this thing and you're like, okay, yeah, Michael Jordan, yeah, I like him. Like, it's, you know, it's really building some steam for him as a person. And then he starts laughing at Gary Payton like he's a fucking joke. And it just, you know, kind of brings back all those memories when the cool kids were wearing the Bulls gear in elementary school, or would that be middle school? And, you know, you were a diehard Sonics fan, and then they lose to the Bulls in the finals. So
I don't feel like I recall experiencing that.
You don't remember that?
Well, just like people that were like rooting for the Bulls against the Sonics in the finals. It was probably different in Eastern Washington where the affinity is not quite as strong.
It wasn't like a lot, but there's definitely a contingent of people who were diehard Michael Jordan fans back in elementary school.
I mean, here's the thing is, Michael Jordan is wrong on this. Like, he shot 6 of 19 in game 5, or game 4. He shot 5 of 19, amazingly, in the clinching game 6, and still won finals MVP. He, over those 3 games that Gary Payton switched on to guard him, shot 37% and averaged 23.7 points per game. Remarkably mortal. Was 1 of 9 from 3-point range in that stretch. It wasn't just GP. Also, Nate McMillan came back for game 4 and game 5. That was a huge difference maker in the series, along with Ron Harper's injury that helped the Sonics win those 2 games. But this is like a classic example of history is written by the victors. So like nobody's going to fact check Michael Jordan's laughing at Gary Payton. It's just going to become a meme.
It's all of those things, though. This is Michael Jordan's documentary. Like, the reason that Sean Kemp isn't mentioned is because Gary Payton was interviewed and said a funny thing for him to retort. Basically, to him. It's like, this isn't
it wasn't a funny thing!
It was funny to Michael Jordan that anybody thought that they could beat the Bulls.
Or that anybody thought that they could stop him. I mean, most players kind of operate like that. Like, they never want to give a defender any credit.
But it's like, who the best player in the 96 finals was doesn't matter. This is a documentary about Michael Jordan. And that's the point. It's not like we're supposed to be looking back with an accurate representation of what the series was actually like. It was, this is making Michael Jordan seem greater than human or whatever. And even when he does seem human, it's always sort of like alien-like. And it works from that perspective. And it's fun to see it this way. Like, if Michael Jordan was like, you know what, Gary Payton was right, we should have lost that series. Like, that would have been really
weird.
You
don't have to say that. You just have to say you tip your cap to that guy.
They made it difficult. Like, that was what you're looking for. Because that was, like, they were a 72-win team during the regular season. They lost 3 games the entire playoffs. That's 13 games they lost all year. 3 of those games were against the Sonics.
You don't have to laugh hysterically like it was the funniest thing anybody had said. It seemed in that moment like he hated him more than Isaiah Thomas. Like, it was...
No, it wasn't hatred. It was just like, you think you're on my level? You're not even close.
Okay, maybe like, sure, bro. But the glove, like just everything he was saying was just mocking him.
Yeah, it was dismissive.
I mean, they won 72 games. Like, also the Sonics, they won games 4 and 5 after they were down 3-0. Like, we do have to have some sort of perspective on this. As like, sure, the way that the finals was set up then, it was set up for the team that was trailing to win some games. But like, the Sonics were not winning that series, whether Gary Payton was defending Michael Jordan or not.
Oh, if Nate McMillan were healthy.
But it's fine. It's honestly, if the Sonics would have lost to anybody else, if they lost to Patrick Ewing, if they lost to, obviously this could have happened, but like Karl Malone in the finals. You know what I mean? Like, those things don't matter.
It wouldn't
have meant
anything, yeah.
They went to the finals, and they lost to arguably the best basketball team of all time, and still won 2 games against them. Like, what the Sonics did was impressive. And Michael Jordan being dismissive of Gary Payton is all part of the process of getting beaten by Michael Jordan. But it's like, it's an honor to, in the 90s, yeah, to have lost to Michael Jordan. Like, this was not the one that we should lament are the 2 years that Michael Jordan wasn't in the league, or at least the 1 year that Michael Jordan wasn't in the league, because then the window was open and the Sonics screwed up that opportunity. They just went to the finals 2 years too late.
That is correct. I mean, the 2 years that he wasn't in the finals. So,
yes.
Yeah.
So, but this one, it's like, it's fun being part of Michael Jordan's story, you know?
Yep.
Where it's like, There are plenty of teams who aren't part of Michael Jordan's story. And that's like, you know, the Suns probably look at this the same way as, you know, they feel like they should have probably won a title at some point in the 90s. But it was just, there was immovable force in the Eastern Conference and the best basketball player of all time.
The difference, so, of course, being they still have a team.
If you want a hater perspective, though, I feel like watching this documentary kind of made Michael Jordan seem like the year he retired was like Michael Jordan's obviously an amazing basketball player, but what seed were the Bulls his first year that he was gone?
They were the 4 seed, I believe.
Okay, so, but they lost in the Eastern Conference Finals.
It was the semifinals.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe they were the 3 seed. I guess, yeah, I don't know.
Still, like, the idea that Michael Jordan was playing with a bunch of chumps or whatever.
I mean, like, I don't think this documentary is trying to advance that at all.
It feels like this was a good Bulls team outside of Michael Jordan. So he was able to have games like that, you know, in that final series where he didn't play all that good, but they still were able to beat the Sonics because I think all around the team was excellent.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I would say all around the team was excellent. Their core was excellent. Like, Scottie Pippen is the best number two player over, like, a sustained stretch. Like, Dwayne Wade was arguably just as good a player, but Scottie Pippen was better in that role, probably, and played it longer. But, like, once you got outside of them, Kukoc, and Rodman, the talent did drop off pretty quickly. Like, the Sonics were definitely the deeper team in that series until, you know, Nate got hurt and George Karl decided just not to play, got angry at Vincent Askew, and he didn't play. Did you leave again?
Sounds like someone's pouring out some water.
Oh, that's the axolotls.
Oh, God, you can hear that? Oh, okay.
Well, only when there's long, extended, awkward silences.
I was giving Katie some space.
I said what I had to say, and I still feel disrespected.
You feel disrespected by Michael Jordan?
Yes.
Just don't tell Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan's going to come find you, and he will embarrass you.
He's a man. Michael Jordan is pissed that he didn't win Pelton Cast MVP this year.
I would be an honor to lose to Jordan as podcast MVP. Same thing, 100%. Okay, 1996 is not actually the year we are remembering. We did that previously, although we may have to go back and redo that more thoroughly at some point. We'll see what we decide to do as this segment continues, because they're not going to play games anytime soon. Instead, our Let's Remember Some Years segment, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza, our friends at Pagliacci Pizza, turns its attention to 2009.
Because Pagliacci is all about redemption. And so is 2009?
Yeah, it was really the bounce back year after the terrible sports year that was 2008. And 2009 featured one of my favorite days ever as a sports fan. March 19th, 2009, a Thursday when, during the afternoon, the Huskies beat Mississippi State 71-58 in the opening round of the NCAA tournament in Portland at 2 p.m., followed at 6 p.m. by the Sounders playing their inaugural MLS match against the New York Red Bulls and winning 3-0 with the fabulous Pelton brothers in attendance.
That whole day was awesome. Like, I think I took the entire day off work, and it was like watching that basketball game and then traveling to the Sounders match. I don't think we really knew what to expect. I mean, we'd been to the couple of USL games where it was an exciting experience, but like being at the first ever Sounders match, the experience was different, you know? And I think that us plus a lot of people throughout Seattle were totally intoxicated by it. They won that match 3-0, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Oh, okay. It was a dominating performance, and it was like, oh, this is a really good soccer team right here from the very beginning. And shortly thereafter, I think we went out and got season tickets for the rest of the year.
Yeah, we had second half season tickets.
Like, that, what we experienced that day, it was like, we need a lot more of this. Because it was great, and I mean, it was so amazing how they were able to fill that void immediately after the Sonics left. And obviously, they don't fill the void completely of not having basketball, but for a lot of people in the city of Seattle, having the Sounders show up at that time was like, it was a little bit healing for us as sports fans.
It was perfect timing, and of course you had the other thing that year that Kevin Calabro had gone from calling Sonics games to calling Sounders games that first season. As hard as it may seem to believe in hindsight that he was calling soccer matches. You mentioned the two U.S. Open Cup games that they had played the previous 2 years where they had reached the semifinals, and those were a lot of fun, but there was like a few thousand fans at those games. This was, they capped the season ticket sales at 22,000. There were, 30,000 plus in the stadium. They could certainly have sold more, but they didn't want to open the upper deck and have empty seats up there at that point. That was kind of their philosophy, which eventually they changed and sold a lot more tickets. The other interesting thing, I talked about this when the Sounders hosted MLS Cup, because it seemed like a culmination in really many ways of what started back in 2009. Like, the whole thing back then was like, oh yeah, everybody's excited about this team because it's new and they're an expansion team, but there's no way this many people are going to keep following the Sounders. And then it, not only did that many people continue, more people jumped on the bandwagon, which was entirely unexpected. All right, so let's talk about UW men's basketball, which experienced its own bounce back after 2 years out of the NCAA tournament, got back as the number 4 seed. We're buoyed by the long-awaited arrival of Tacoma product Isaiah Thomas after a year in prep school, and Thomas really made everything click. He came in and played point guard that moved Justin Dentman off the ball, and after 2 years of struggling as a point guard, he enjoyed the best season of his career as a shooting guard, has since gone on to a really long professional career. Quincy Pondexter, as a junior, came into his own during conference play. And after starting 2-3, two of those losses coming to national powers Kansas and Florida in a tournament in Kansas City, thus he's won 13 of their next 14 and finished 14-4 in Pac-10 play. They were upset by a James Harden-led Arizona State team in the semifinals of the Pac-10 tournament, but still got to stay home in the Pacific Northwest for the NCAA tournament. They cruised past a Mississippi State team led by shot blocker extraordinaire Jarvis Venardo that won the SEC tournament to become the 13 seed in an oddity before losing 76-74 to Purdue in the second round despite 20-plus points from all of Pondexter, Thomas, and John Brockman, who was playing his final UW game. Had two potential tying shots in the final minute of that one, blocked by Jawan Johnson, and that prevented them from moving on. The winner of that game was going to play top seed UConn in the Sweet 16, which, as you know, definitely would have ended well for UW.
I can't remember if this is when people on, the Dog Man forums that I frequent started hating on Isaiah Thomas for dribbling the ball too much or being a ball hog, but I know that happened at some point, and I remember being very angry at those people.
As you should have been. I feel like that probably was more likely during his sophomore season, because like, he was just so exciting as a freshman, especially, the team had been so disappointing the previous 2 years.
You would be surprised what people hate, though.
I would not be. I expect it.
You'd be surprised what people hate.
But do you remember when James Harden went into the league? Did you think he was going to be as good as he turned out to be?
So it's interesting. I have a friend who I talk basketball with and really respect his opinion a lot. And we've disagreed about two prospects in particular that came into the league as like high picks. And he thought they weren't athletic enough. And I was like, they remind me of Brandon Roy with the way they play and the way they're under control and, control of the game. And one of those guys was James Harden, which I was right about. And the other was Evan Turner, which I was not right about. I was pretty high on Harden coming into the league. I thought he was going to be really good. I didn't think he was going to be an MVP. I did not expect this.
Didn't you like him, Tristan?
Not that much. I think you're thinking of Nick Young.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, that is weird.
Who's my dude. Love Nick Young. But I remember we went to go see Arizona State because we were graduated from college and didn't have season tickets anymore at this point. And this was his last time playing in Seattle, right?
Correct.
And I remember we were in the end zone, the rafters where we sit, and seeing him in the corner, like nailing a lefty three in front of us. And I was just like, oh, that guy is good. I think he had a pretty monster game against the Huskies in that game against ASU.
I don't have that specifically, but I would imagine so. I remember there was a lot of, like, Darnell Gant was guarding him.
My God, Darnell Gant.
Which, that's a lot to ask for Darnell Gant.
Yeah, when you think back on that, like, the trajectories of the two.
Oh, very different.
How do you not have Coupon on James Harden? Like, the Huskies probably had one of the best possible players in all of college basketball to defend James Harden, and they were like, Gant's got it.
I don't know. Harden did not actually have a big game in Seattle that year. 19 points on 7 of 19 shooting.
Jordan-like, almost.
Darnell Gant was his... with his glove.
All right.
His big game against the Huskies was in the Pac-10 tournament, like I mentioned. That was he really keyed that victory. I remember I wrote a column about that one for Basketball Prospectus. 24 points, 9 rebounds, 7 of 13 from the field, 7 of 9 from the line.
I just think I remember seeing him in front of us, no beard, knocking down a lefty three, and I think he drove and hit the like lefty dunk from the baseline. It was like, whoa, that is, it was just not normal things to see a college player do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all in all, a good year despite a like falling a little bit short of where they could have made it to the Sweet 16 that year. The Sounders, they debuted as contenders, starting with that win against the Red Bulls. Won their first 3 matches that season without conceding a goal. Freddie Montero was named the MLS Player of the Month for March with 3 goals in the first 2 games. The Sounders that year would win their first U.S. Open Cup 2-1 at DC United after winning 4 matches in the run at Starfire Stadium in Tequila. Midseason hosted friendlies against both Chelsea, a 2-0 loss, and FC Barcelona, a 4-0 loss, with Messi scoring a pair of goals in that one, which was a lot of fun to attend. Lots of draws midseason for the Sounders, including a stretch of 5 in a row, but then they finished with 3 consecutive wins to take 3rd in the Western Conference in their inaugural season. Montero behind a team-high 12 goals from Freddie Montero. Then in the conference semifinals, lost 1-0 after extra time to number 2 seed Houston in that one. Then the MLS Cup was played that year at Quest Field, with Real Salt Lake beating LA Galaxy on PKs.
Pretty fun stretch also. Whereas, like, I think the playoff match was on Halloween, if I recall correctly. And
no, we had you're not thinking of the right year. We didn't go to that game.
This was another year that it was on Halloween?
Yeah, that was a different year.
I just remember them playing a really frustrating playoff match on Halloween.
Well, so for a long period of time, most of the Sounders playoff games were pretty frustrating.
We had season tickets, but didn't go to the playoff match.
I don't remember going to the playoff. I mean, maybe you did, but it wasn't. You're thinking of. It was on October 29th, so I guess it was around Halloween.
Well, and then also leading into, I just remember, like, we had started realizing just how long the MLS season was this year, because we'd got those season tickets in May or June or whatever, and it was like, yeah, we'll just go to these Sounders matches over the summer, and then all of a sudden we were missing a lot of them because of Husky football games,
right.
And it was like, how long does this sport play for? And then finally we found ourselves on November 22nd at the MLS Cup final, and it was
cold.
Okay. This league lasts for all time. It is a 24-month sport. It lasts for more than a year.
What wouldn't you give right now to have a sport that lasts for entire
I mean, this MLS season may last for 24 months. Some of these seasons, the NBA season, who knows? You're thinking of, I believe, of the 2010 season. They played at home on Halloween. And I think we bought tickets in the 200 level for that
one. We did. Yeah.
That was at the point where they were all-inclusive tickets.
Yes, we got a lot of nachos.
Yeah, yeah, solid number of nachos. But we will remember that in 2000.
Katie was there. Do you remember this at all, Katie?
No idea. I have no idea what you're talking about. What?
Never even heard of the sport.
It was a fun game because the weather was like not bad. It was probably cold, but it was completely clear that night.
Had the unlimited nachos?
Yeah. You were there. You were eating nachos. We had hot dogs, nachos. Ben was there.
Really?
Yeah, this was your life.
No recollection.
Well, maybe we'll call this one, which is UW football hiring Steve Sarkisian is the replacement for Tyrone Willingham. He was introduced on December 8th, 2008. The Huskies, they eased him in by hosting number 11 LSU in their opening game, but had a respectable 31-23 loss in that one, then beat Idaho in their next game to snap the nation's longest losing streak at 15 games before hosting number 3 USC and Sark's mentor, Pete Carroll. The Huskies win that game 16-13 on Eric Folk's field goal in the closing seconds, beating backup quarterback Aaron Korp, who started due to injury. And fans then storm the field.
Hello! I mean, that game was huge. Beating USC after going a year without a victory. It's like Sark was anointed in that moment. And USC, of all teams, they were the team of the 2000s, not in just the Pac-10, but across the country. And so beating them, Sark's former mentor, like, the whole experience was incredible.
I mean, whatever else happened the rest of the season, particularly in the desert, Sark's teams always got up for USC. There was always a little something extra. So the Huskies were actually ranked after that win for the first time since 2003 before getting blown out by Stanford 34-14. Behind 200 yards from Toby Gearhart. Yeah. That's like one of the most memorable viewing experiences ever for me, because that game was on Fox College Sports, and it was the broadcast where Sean Farnham referred to the University of Washington as being in Bellevue.
Oh, yeah.
It sure was. It 100% was. We watched that at Katie's house in Bellevue.
I do remember that now. Yeah.
Home of the Washington Huskies.
That's true. We were right there on campus in Bellevue.
I would have guessed that it was – I didn't realize it was Sean Farnham. I thought that was Papadopoulos who said that.
No. It was Farnham was doing play-by-play at that point before going back to doing color on basketball games. And his explanation was when he played at UCLA on the basketball team, and they always stayed in Bellevue when they went and played at UW, and he did not realize they were crossing a bridge to get to the arena.
So the
next week, Huskies continue.
UCLA game's very nice in the Inland Empire.
Very difficult schedule that year. Play at Notre Dame, lose 37-30, in a game where they were leading 24-22 and then ran 7 plays from either the 1 or 2 without scoring before settling for a field goal with 3:04 left in regulation, and then went on to lose that one in the extra session.
That was devastating. I mean, having, again, a year after not winning a game, being in the position to beat Notre Dame on the road in South Bend and having those 7 plays, it's like, just put the fucking ball in. Come on.
So then they lost 4 in a row at one point during Pac-12 play. Was this the Arizona State game? Was that the one we were at the Jay-Z concert? I'm pretty sure this was, yes. Tied 17-17, they give up a 50-yard touchdown pass with 5 seconds left. That was a real ugly finish. The desert was always rough for Sark.
This wasn't the year of the squats, though.
No, the squats was a daytime game. This was a night game. We DVR'd it and watched it after we came back from the Jay-Z concert or something. That's my vague recollection.
We were at Ozzy's drinking before the Jay-Z concert.
Not Ozzy's. It was, you know, the other place. Buckley's.
We were at Buckley's before.
I'm pretty sure we were at Buckley's.
And then we went to go see Hove. Was this the year that I think I forgot to mention, when did I work for the Storm?
I think it might have been then.
I mean, it definitely was. I went to Vegas to see Jay-Z before this. It was summer. It might have been 2008. I guess it would have been 2009.
Yes, I have the T. Pelton at stormbasketball.com email address from 2009, so that appears
there. We go. Wow. 2009.
The summer you were working
for
the Storm.
Seattle Storm had an excellent year.
Well, we're going to get to them later. You can bring that up later. So the Huskies finish out Pac-10 play at the time, actually, with back-to-back blowout home wins, beating Wazoo in the Apple Cup 30-0, and then running roughshod over number 19 Cal in a 42-10 victory, with fans chanting "One more year for Jake Locker," who went 19 of 23 for 248 yards and 3 touchdowns, with 77 yards and 2 touchdowns on the ground in that one.
Wow. It would be less than like 9 months later that somebody yelled "burn your jersey" at your Jake Locker jersey.
Look, we're going to talk about that in 2010. Yeah, but people were so excited about Jake coming back at that point. And then they got their wish, and be careful what you wish for. You just might get it.
Do you guys remember being super excited about Sark? Or is that just me?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, of course. Yeah, he was an exciting up-and-coming coach. I mean, I wanted them to hire Mike Leach at the time, but I was certainly excited about Sark. Look, there was a lot I did not know about Mike Leach back then. So much.
Oh, Lord. That wouldn't have worked out.
He was just the quirky coach who ran an innovative offense.
He couldn't have come here. He's still reeling after the 2008 election.
Just as like a thought experiment, like what if we had hired him and he recruited really well and actually somehow had a defense and had the same offense that he, you know.
I mean, they would probably have lost every big game because, you know, for the same reason that UW always beat Wazoo in the Apple Cup. But yeah. I mean, I think he would have been successful. I don't think he would have done poorly. I think he probably would have been miserable.
Oh, I think he would have loved it, but I think certain Husky fans would have been miserable.
His people aren't here. His people are not here.
Maybe he would have moved UW to Bellevue.
further east. I remember the Bark for Sark t-shirts that all the frat kids had that year. Yeah.
I'm still excited about Sark. Like, I don't feel like the negativity about Sark. He brought us back. Like, no matter what happened in the end with Sark, which really wasn't ultimately that bad, you know, like nothing really that bad happened when he was at UW. He was the person who brought the program back. He was the person who put them in the position to be able to hire Chris Peterson. Like, Chris Peterson wasn't taking over that job for Tyron Willingham.
No.
I mean, I think it also was just a different time for Chris Peterson. I think Sark's tenure is overrated to the extent that, like, they weren't that much different. But he definitely inspired hope in the fan base, and that was an important thing at that time.
And he changed recruiting, I think.
Yeah. That first recruiting class was not good. I looked that up as part of remembering this year, and they did not get anyone that year.
Not really.
Wasn't it a bridge recruiting class, though?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, he took over. In December, he took over a team that went 0-12. I'm not blaming him.
I mean, some of the recruiting classes that Sark had were excellent.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of the talent that was on the team that went to the playoff. So, yeah. I mean, I have nothing negative to say about I guess I may have some negative things to say. But overall, I think Sark's tenure on Montlake was a success.
Sark did nothing wrong.
Well.
You know. So the Mariners, they brought back Ken Griffey Jr. in 2009. The groundwork for his return was laid by his 2007 trip back to Safeco Field as a visiting player with Cincinnati during interleague play, during which he went 5 of 13 with 2 home runs. And you know, I remember, like, that was one of the Mariners games I was most excited to watch in the last 15 years, was like Griffey's first game back in Seattle.
He was still with Cincinnati in 2007?
Yeah, he did not get traded to Chicago until 2008 for the stretch run, and then after that signed with the Mariners.
I thought he played for Atlanta at some point.
No, that is not the case.
Ken Griffey Jr. never played for the Braves?
No.
Really?
I mean, unless I really missed something here.
I'm completely making this up.
I think you are. Senior might have played for the Braves. I don't know about that.
We'll see what Baseball Reference has to say about this. And then if they don't say it, I'll say that they're lying.
It's a Mandela effect.
Wow, I really remember Ken Griffey Jr. being on the Braves. So the only other team he played for, and he played a shortened season with the White Sox. So he basically only played for the Mariners and the Reds.
Correct.
I just, dude, God, he just does not like major markets.
I mean, that was his hometown in Cincinnati, so that was the appeal. He signed with the Mariners in February, a little more than 9 years after his trade to the Reds. At age 39, playing primarily DH, hit just 214 with 19 home runs and a respectable 735 ops. And the M's went back up on their late 2000s roller coaster, winning 24 more games than the previous season under the new regime of GM Jack Zarencic and manager Don Wakamatsu. Felix Hernandez went 19-5 with a 2.49 ERA, finishing second in Cy Young voting at age 23. In less positive news, the Seahawks were one and done with Jim Elmora, who was the designated successor for Mike Holmgren after serving the previous year as assistant head coach in the secondary. The Seahawks won their opener 28-0 over St. Louis, but then lost five of their next six games, a stretch that was highlighted by a 25-19 home loss to Chicago in the debut of Action Green uniforms. That version, I think it was the only time they ever wore in that one, wasn't it? Like, those were the ones with, like, the blue sleeves, and they sold a shit ton of those jerseys because everyone was so excited about them, but they played so terribly in that game they never wore them again. So Seneca Wallace was at QB in that game.
Oh, gosh.
And that was the game where Orlando Morey missed two makeable field goals from 34 and 43 yards. And after the game, Mora lit into him and lost me forever.
Nobody was more upset about that than you.
That would have been an area of grievances for sure. If they had a podcast in 2009. Retro
an emergency pod about the Orlando Morey game. I don't think I'm
going to have to do that.
We got some time on our hands.
No sports for so long, you're going to have to go back and recreate emergency pods.
There are worse ideas, as it turns out.
Jim Mora is sort of like the anti-Sark in a lot of ways, where it's like, I have nothing but bad memories about Jim Mora. And he was anointed, right? Like, his dad was on the 91 championship team, is that right? Or was he on it?
I don't think either of them. His dad had previously coached under Don James, and Jim Elmora was a walk-on player on the team in the 80s, but I don't think anyone was around by 91. The older Jim Mora, Jim, I think E. Mora, was coaching the Saints by 91.
Oh, well, good for him.
I mean, that was pretty good for him. He was like the most successful coach in Saints history until Sean Payton got there.
That's something. But as somebody who was homegrown, who we were always pining for, maybe never was actually a very good coach and just kind of lucked into Mike Vick for a couple of seasons. But he was like, Jim Mora was the one who got away for so long. And definitely, as you talk about being careful what you wish for, like, Jim Mora coming back to Seattle was such a failed experiment, and then him choosing to take the UCLA job over UW, when UW definitely dodged a bullet with that one.
Not over UW. UW wasn't open at the time he took the UCLA job. Sark was there.
Or chose not to come to UW or whatever. But, like,
yes.
I feel like Jim Mora has just – he's done really nothing but wrong since the moment that he said that he would consider leaving the Falcons. – This was for the UW job at the time, right?
On KJR? That is correct, yes. Yes.
From that very moment, I mean, we were so excited about the idea of Jim Mora coming and being the UW coach. Because, again, times were bleak at that time period. But
also, you're forgetting how good he was at UCLA at the start. Like, those recruiting classes were amazing. He kept getting guys from Bellevue, like Miles Jack.
Sean Farnham's home. He goes deep in Bellevue.
Sean Farnham was a UCLA guy. It made sense. He was helping him recruit in Bellevue.
I remember thinking, like, UW will never get another locally grown player ever again because Jim Mora is out there.
It really was a thought at the time. Yeah.
So. But it's just the whole thing. Everywhere he went, it's just, I mean, it's like this with a lot of coaches. He failed so much faster as the head coach of the Seahawks than I think any of us anticipated, though. And to be an experienced NFL coach who's coached in the playoffs. Like, Jim Mora wasn't a joke when he was the coach of the Seahawks, or at least prior to being the coach of the Seahawks. And that was it. He was done. Like, that one season, it felt like everybody around the NFL was like, all right, this dude is not ready to be an NFL coach.
And I mean, it's weird that it was a one-season tenure. Like, you don't usually see that when people were so excited about someone going in. I mean, oddly, one of the other coaches who had a one-and-done tenure, Pete Carroll with the Jets.
Sometimes the fit just isn't right.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know.
I think you have to give a lot of respect to Paul Allen and the front office at the time for recognizing that Jim Mora was just not right to be the head coach of the Seahawks, and to get him out as quickly as possible, and also recognizing that there was this opportunity to go get an exciting college coach and bring him to Seattle. Did that happen in 2009 also? Or is that 2010?
It technically happened in 2010. Okay. Mora was fired on January 8th. So we'll talk about that. But the other part of it was financial. Mora had $12 million left on his contract when he was fired. And then they go out and make Pete Carroll, like, maybe one of the, you know, probably two or three highest paid coaches in the NFL. So Paul Allen stepped to the plate there for sure. But we'll talk more about that in 2010.
It was, but the one season tenure, like, I think the Olindo Mari thing, it's weird because, you know, really throwing a kicker under the bus is kind of.
And he ultimately didn't cut him, which would have been a huge mistake.
But Olindo Mari was more respected than Jim Mora was. Whereas, like, there are certain kickers that you probably could have thrown under the bus, but Olindo Mari wasn't it. Like, he was a respected, seemed like teammate and member of the Seahawks, and Jim Mora just didn't have the clout to be able to do that so early on, right? And he just, like, he acted like people respected him more, and he was throwing somebody else in the bus, and was like, it's not gonna happen, dude. And I think that ultimately really affected his tenure with the Seahawks.
It certainly did in my mind. Like, just the process of that, the logic behind it was so galling to me. I was out on Jim Mora forever.
Were you ever in on Jim Mora? Or were you out on him prior?
I can't really remember how I felt about him at the start of 2009. That's so long ago. I probably didn't have any strong feelings either way.
What was the vibe of the message boards, of the Dogman boards on Jim Mora, Katie?
I thought they were mad at him, but I don't remember when it was, but very mad at him for not coming to UW, but I don't remember when that was.
I mean, that was when we hired Coach Pete, so.
But I think before that point, they definitely wanted.
I mean, you can go back in the Peltoncast archives and listen to the Sark Goes to USC.
Oh, God, don't.
Emergency pod. Don't do that. Oh, one of my personal favorites, where Third Pelton brother Chris Smith advocates fiercely for Jim Mora to be the next head coach.
He was not as upset about the Olindo Mari situation as you were.
No, clearly not. I'm sure I talked about the Olindo Mari thing on there. It really irked me.
He probably would have released Eric Folk before he could have kicked that field goal.
Well, really makes you think.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that is a strange year in Seahawks history. I mean, because, you know, for the last two decades, there haven't been that many teams that have had so few coaches. And the Seahawks went from this one super long tenure of a head coach to this one random year in between to another super long tenure of a head coach.
Yeah, it's like if the Steelers had had someone for 1 year in between Bill Cowher and Mike Tomlin. But they didn't.
I guess you do have to say, though, this season and the losing in the season set them up for that first draft class that, you know, Pete and John, as the new regime, really knocked out of the park with the Earl Thomas. Where did they get that draft pick from, the second first round pick?
They had traded their second round pick in 2009 to Denver for a first round pick in 2010.
God.
In the second round pick, it was like, I want to say Alphonso Ford, but Alphonso Ford was a briefly member of the Sonics.
I thought that was his name too. Something, isn't it a cornerback?
I think his name is Alphonso. It might be like Alphonso Smith.
And so the Broncos just needed Alphonso Smith, but they were willing to give up what ended up being the 13th pick in the draft, I want to say.
Yeah, Alphonso Smith was the 37th pick, and he lasted like one season with the Broncos. It's so ridiculous. They traded that guy and could have had Earl Thomas.
Man. But yeah, this season set the Seahawks up. I mean, you have to say that part of their core of the, you know, what became the Super Bowl winning team eventually was definitely, you know, offensively on the offensive line, Russell Okung, and then defensively having Earl Thomas as the center field of that defensive backfield.
Man, the Seahawks rewatch last week was the game against, it was a game where they got torched defensively and Earl Thomas got badly beaten on one of those plays, but their victory against Deshaun Watson and the Texans in Deshaun Watson's rookie season. And it was the last game ever. Earl Thomas gets hurt at the end of that game on Deshaun Hopkins' long touchdown that the Seahawks had to come back from. Yes. It was the very last play. Ben B pointed out that Thomas, Sherman, and Cam Chancellor were on the field together ever. So.
We weep.
Getting emotional. So the Seattle Storm lost in the first round again. They did get some good news before the season. Is Lauren Jackson.
When they laid me off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the best move they ever made. Lauren Jackson became an unrestricted free agent for the first time and seriously weighed leaving the Storm for Phoenix before re-signing in May. She was healthy much of the season, but was ruled out after stress fractures in her back were discovered late in the regular season. Storm still finished second in the West at 20-14, but without Jackson, were outmatched against LA in the first round, needing a miracle finish with a stolen inbounds pass and go-ahead layup with 5 seconds left to force game three of that series at home and losing that one 75-64. Also on the basketball front, 2009, really the end of 2008, but we're counting this as the 2009 season. The Blazers became our local team with the departure of the Sonics. And it was a good time to jump on the Portland bandwagon as they returned to the playoffs for the first time since 2003 with 54 wins, their most since 2000. Greg Oden, in his rookie campaign after missing his first year due to microfracture and knee surgery, played 61 games, averaging 8.9 points and 7.0 rebounds per game, and Brandon Roy enjoyed the best season of his career, voted All-NBA second team. He had an OT game winner versus Houston in the second home game of the season, and the second game that I attended down in Portland as a member of the quote-unquote national media, and then a career-high 52 points against Phoenix in December. The Blazers hosted the Rockets in the first round that year, but lost the series 4-2.
I think this was a brief period of time where it was actually our Blazers for me because they had Brandon Roy.
And also, Tristan mentioned this, Martell Webster got an extension on opening night, a story that created the friendship between Ben Golliver and I. Exciting times.
You became friends because of Martell Webster's extension?
Well, so what happened is that happened on the night of opening night, which I think was probably Halloween because that would have been the deadline.
We were at the Sounders match.
Yes. Yes. You're in the future at the Sounders match. I had open BlazersEdge.com, which he was writing for at the time, and was reading about his story about the Martell Webster extension. He was sitting next to me. He was like, and that started the conversation between us.
He's like what you're reading?
He's always giving me shit about, like, you wouldn't just ask me about it, just you had to read the site sitting next to me. But infamously that night, he asked me what I thought about Sam Presti, and it was like the longest pause I have ever given before answering a question.
It was like that extremely long pause that we had earlier.
Yeah, very similar,
Shots to you were match, though.
You were just trying to give Katie some space.
Be here.
Shouts to Blazers Edge.
Always. Should we talk about music?
I just don't feel like we've really... Our Blazers thing, I mentioned this last week, Katie. You, of course, didn't listen, because as Peltoncast MVP, you never listen to the Peltoncast.
Well, I'm very busy.
You've been...
Are you?
Very busy?
No. I explained that there's nothing fun to be doing right now. You can't be driving or doing anything of fun, and that's what
there's one thing fun to be doing.
What's that?
Listening to the Pelton Cast.
Oh, well, I...
It's a versatile activity. You can do it, you know, various housework, anything around the house, and staying several feet away from anyone else, even in your own household.
Listen, I don't just don't have the mental energy right now to be listening to you people.
Well, I'm glad you have the mental energy to join us on the pod.
Us people. You're very busy. The internet is not going to read itself. Oh, my God.
No, but you were talking about our Blazers, or so I think you had some sort of point. Or something.
Oh, we were talking about the draft lottery. And the previous year when the Northwest went 1-2, and I remember talking to you and you're so fired up that the Blazers got the number one pick. And then I was like, what pick did the Sonics get? And you're like, number two. But it was like the conversation that we had was around what pick the Blazers got, not the Sonics.
That was me?
Yeah.
Oh, huh. Well, yeah, because Brandon Roy.
First off, Katie's in no position to dispute that right now.
What?
She clearly does not remember 2009.
No, reflection here. Not.
Oh my God.
I don't know how you've been for specific years. It's crazy to me. Everything is just one giant blur.
It's the events that happened in the specific years.
It's remembering exactly where you watched the games.
Yeah, that's...
I didn't mention, by the way, that Olindo Mari game. I think that was the only Seahawks game I attended that season.
Oh, you were.
I definitely was there. Yeah, I was sitting in the Hawk's Nest. I think I was, or maybe in the 300 level on that end.
You put the accent on the wrong word there. You pulled a Jan.
Wait, which one did I accent?
You accented Nest.
The Hawk's Nest. Is that worse?
Can forever heretofore putting the accent on the wrong word or the wrong syllable be called pulling a Jan?
Groupon. I see why Candy is the MVP. The episodes aren't very good when she's on.
Did you hear what the word was that you were just pronouncing? Katie, did you hear that?
Paul Allen?
No, that Al just pronounced.
What word? What?
Groupon.
That's a Jan. Jan pronounces Groupon like it's Grey Poupon.
What?
She really does.
She puts the accent on the P.
Groupon.
I've tried to explain it so many times that it rhymes with coupon. That's also how she pronounced Quincy Pondexter's nickname.
My mother-in-law likes to call LA Fitness La Fitness.
La Fitness. Man, we should,
I always think of LaMarcus
to pronounce Chipotle too. Chipotle.
I actually like pronouncing it Chipotle. Oh, I would never do it in public.
That was,
but
that was an honor, an homage to Jan.
Quesadilla. You do that in private. You use those words in private. Quesadilla. Chipotle.
Anyway, so you're saying the Hawk's Nest. This also...
I didn't have any more about that story.
2009 was my first year with season tickets to the Seattle Seahawks, if you will.
Well, there you go. Was there a year where you didn't have season tickets in there?
I didn't have season tickets.
Chris didn't have season tickets.
Yeah, Chris and I have both taken a year off. I think me, because I just couldn't... I literally just could not get my shit together enough to say that I wanted to, like, call the Seahawks or whatever and ask to be put on the account, because paperwork is not a strong point of the Fabulous Pelton Brothers. And then there was another year that Chris... I needed somebody else to do it for me, and nobody else was willing to do it for me, so... and then one year Chris thought he was moving, so he didn't have tickets. So, yeah, you know. We're even now. He had to sit all alone. I think this was 2010. It was the first Pete Carroll year that I didn't have season tickets.
Right,
and so
that's
he had
what I thought.
It was
a year you did, and then the year you didn't.
It's probably refreshing.
I don't mind sitting alone with games.
No, it was the second Pete Carroll year. I had season tickets for the first year. I was there for the Beastquake, and then I skipped the Tavares Jackson year and came back for Russell Wilson. So.
Well, that was pretty good timing.
Yeah, that worked out.
But don't spoil future Remember Some Years. I don't want to give away the ending.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, someone asked me if I knew it was in the next Last Dance. I was like, well, I got an idea. They win the championship and then Jordan retires.
Okay, wait, this is a question for Katie, if she remembers this, of course.
No.
The defender who Michael Jordan hits the last shot of his career over, what is his name?
Craig Elo? I don't know.
He was on the Jazz.
Sadly, Craig Elo's career had come to an end after his time
John
in Seattle.
Stockton? I don't know. Is this something I'm supposed to know?
You're trying to get at the difference between Brian Russell and Byron Russell?
Legit thought his name was Byron Russell.
We always would chant that at him during games.
There was a podcast that Simmons and Russillo were doing where they were like, name an average player from the 90s or whatever. And Simmons goes, Brian Russell. And I'm like, who the fuck is Brian Russell? I was like, I think he was a safety for the Vikings or something.
But Brian Russell was a safety, yes.
I went and looked it up where I was like, that's wrong. His name is Byron. And then I was like, oh, no shit. Apparently his name is Brian.
Brian Russell played for the Seahawks. Did you know that?
I do remember him playing for the Seahawks, yeah. He was on the Browns for a long time.
Is that right? Two seasons. Vikings were his primary team.
Look, we know everything about that Brian Russell. And you don't even remember 2009, Katie.
This is something that I was supposed to, like, people know who Michael Jordan hit his last shot over?
Most people know that.
I mean, I don't know how many people, but people do know it, yeah.
Nope. That is not something in the memory hole.
I was curious if you remembered him as Brian or Byron.
I do not remember him as either.
You remember him as Craig Elo. It's actually so much more insulting to Brian and or Byron Russell that you remember him as Craig Elo.
You know, yeah, probably yes. Can we talk about music now?
We're not talking about my Storm tenure. We're just going to yada 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 over that.
Haven't you already told this story enough times on the podcast?
Okay, fine.
Yeah, you got fired by the Storm. You actually didn't get fired. You got laid off. They didn't replace your position. But on the last day, you were asked to leave because you wore shirts and shorts and Karen Bryant shirts. Multiple shirts. Shorts. And Karen Bryant asked if this was an FU to her? Is that the question? Am I remembering that correctly?
You told the story. We're good.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's it. So in 2009, we have the debut of the XX with XX. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I didn't listen to them at the time.
Okay, so that's interesting. I didn't listen to them at the time either. I don't know exactly when this was, but the first time I listened to the XX is Sue Bird. She used to do these chats for the Seattle Times, and they would like come in and set up in our conference room, and I would transcribe things for the chat. Like she was just saying her answers, and I was transcribing them. And someone asked her about music, and she recommended the Notorious XX.
I was gonna say I thought you were gonna bring up Notorious XX.
Yeah, it's very similar to like how I got into the Black Album through the Gray Album. Same thing with XX through Notorious XX, which of course is a mashup of Biggie and the XX album, and is great for the record.
Which is great?
All of it.
Yeah, all three. All three parts.
Okay.
Everything is great.
Why is it that if I hear a mashup today, that I would take my phone and throw it into the ocean? But in 2009, I was just like, this is perfect. I was like,
I'm still here for mashups.
Be an indie rock band mashed up with a famous rapper, and that's all we need. We're done with music. It's been settled.
What year did that guy who does all the mashups have the
Girl Talk?
Yeah.
We've already remembered it.
Let's Remember Some Years. You would have heard us remember Girl Talk in the previous, actually multiple years.
Yeah.
But Night River came out in 2007, is that right?
I think it was 6.
And then he played
one of those two.
Block Party in both 2007 and 2008.
There was just a lot of mashup listening.
It's all we listen to.
So there was an EP that came out in 2009 by a young man named Aubrey Graham called So Far Gone. And that began the Drake era, which still continues to this day.
God, especially for you.
Well, yes. I don't dispute that. I mean...
Wait, does the XX album have the song that we that my husband and I used at our wedding on it?
I gotta admit that. I don't specifically remember.
Probably?
Intro? The intro?
Yeah, that's the first XX intro song ever.
It's the intro to the album.
Good song. Okay.
You used that at your wedding? Well, I didn't even know this.
Yeah.
Well, you'll remember a lot about that night. There's a lot, you know. That was 2009, wasn't it?
Yeah. No.
I have
no idea. Oh, no, your wedding was 2009. Their wedding was 2011.
No, their wedding is 2 years later or 1 year later?
2 years later. Mm. Carcino weddings only happened in odd-numbered years at that point.
Okay.
Best I ever had, though, that was, like, so ubiquitous at that point, really put Drake on the map.
I remembered him as the person from Degrassi.
Did you actually watch Degrassi?
I definitely was aware of Degrassi.
I mean, I think you were aware of it because everyone said, like, who's this guy Drake?
And they
were
like,
oh, he was on Degrassi. That's true. The memes were a thing. Okay, also from 2009, Jay-Z drops The Blueprint 3 ahead of that tour that we saw at Kirita. And a fun fact about The Blueprint 3, I went and reviewed this. I am almost certain that it is the very last CD I ever purchased.
Wow.
Didn't you buy Chinese Democracy? What year did you buy that?
That was 2008. We did not remember it. It was not worth remembering. I bought that just for the novelty.
So this was the peak of my Jay-Z fandom. So I remember there was a time. So Jay-Z had retired, similar to me earlier in this episode, and he came back and like wasn't really playing shows. I think this was before the 360 Live Nation deal, and he was playing a show in Vegas at the Palms. Right? And the tickets were insanely expensive. And it was over the 4th of July. I think we went on the 4th of July. And I was just like, fuck it. Like, this, man, not having children was awesome. But I was like, I think we're just, me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius are just going to go to Vegas on the 4th of July and see Jay-Z. Maybe we saw him on like the 3rd of July and then the 4th, like went and did Vegas stuff. But it was... Jay-Z wasn't touring. He hadn't toured for a number of years at that point. And I was like, you know, there aren't going to be that many opportunities to see Jay-Z. And then, of course, Jay-Z has performed in Seattle like 30
times.
So
many
times,
yeah.
And I've seen him most of those times since then. But it seemed so unique at the time to go. And then I think he probably announced the show that we went to. That was that fall. It couldn't have been that much later. But I think the Blueprint 3 wasn't fully out yet. And it was before that New York song hit, when it's called NY State of Mind or whatever.
I remember that Midsummer. Like, I distinctly remember listening to that. Like, the Storm players listening to that in the locker room before every game.
But
Jay-Z had been on a tour in 2008. It just didn't come to Seattle.
But Death of Autotune, which I think that was one of the first singles from Blueprint 3. And I was like, oh, shit. Hearing it, I was like, Jay-Z did it to him. Autotune is dead forever. And then Autotune's career has lasted longer than Jay-Z's.
Jay-Z's career still goes on. What are you talking about?
Is this that one where people started really not liking it, Jay-Z?
No, this was a very popular album.
Popular, but...
People didn't like Jay-Z previously on Magna Carta Holy Grail, right? Or no. Was that after? What was the one that had that Show Me What You Got song, Al? That was Magna Carta Holy Grail, right?
He had Kingdom Come was his last
Kingdom Come.
Solo album.
Yeah, so people started disliking him on Kingdom Come, and then people really disliked him on Magna Carta Holy Grail. Because I think that was the one that like you had downloaded on T-Mobile phones or whatever.
No, you're thinking of the U2 album.
That came
Anytime that you have an album that is immediately or only available to people on specific phones, which thank God does not happen anymore, you're asking to become one of the most hated artists.
I mean, both Empire State of the Mind. I mean, Empire State of Mind was everywhere, and then Run This Town was most places.
See, and now I feel like people hate Empire State of Mind, right?
Yeah, because it got played too much.
Yeah.
It was too popular.
That's true.
Knicks and Nets give me high fives.
And that's a deep album. Like, I'm a big fan of Young Forever and A Star Is Born.
Wait, I actually hate Young Forever.
I also hate Young Forever.
I like that song.
But it was
Blueprint 3 was pretty good, all things considered. And it was definitely Jay-Z's return to, like, widespread popularity, where he became...
It was Jay-Z switching back to the 23.
Yeah.
Okay, so the last album I had on here that I thought we needed to talk about from 2009 was Man on the Moon, The End of the Day, the Kid Cudi debut.
Crush a bit, a little bit, roll it up, take a hit. And we talked about 808s previously as a groundbreaking album that sort of predicted the future. And I think Man on the Moon is definitely the other one alongside those, where the next decade of hip-hop was extremely influenced by what Kid Cudi was doing at this time.
Which Cudi had also co-written part of 808s. Yeah, I mean, it was a very different, like, than... He was a move further into, like, emo hip-hop. Which Drake would obviously take over.
Drake's, like, the mainstream version of it, though. Drake is, like, the maximalist version. You know? Everything that Drake does, ultimately, even if you respect him as an artist, is, like, it is to increase the popularity of Drake. Right? Like, you don't release the Tootsie Slide if you're not trying to get, like, a fucking dance on TikTok. That's not the type of artist that Kid Cudi is. Right? Like,
agreed.
Kid Cudi has a little bit more of an artistic vision than somebody like Drake does. And I think he probably still... And this is not even... I'm not even, like, really a Kid Cudi fan at all, but...
Wait, you're not?
No, I've, like,
never... You loved Kids See Ghosts.
I like Kids See Ghosts. I really like a song on Kids See Ghosts.
Okay. Okay.
I enjoy the songs that he does with Kanye now. Or didn't he have Kanye in a couple songs recently?
Yeah.
Like, they're the only songs that I like off the new albums. So...
Yeah, I think they're very good together. But I have never once sat and listened to Man on the Moon all the way through.
Really?
Yeah.
But you love 808.
As recently as this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Huh. Who, though, watched the show with Kid Cudi on HBO? That was a show.
Only you.
The show?
I remember seeing the ads for it and be like, oh, Kid Cudi's on that show, and then being like, I should tune into that, and then not tuning into that. What was that show called?
Something About America, or...
Oh, yeah.
New York, or...
Oh, you're talking about How to Make It in America.
Yeah, How to Make It in America. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That was a show.
Yeah, only you.
Was that not...
Never
no, I think other people watch that.
Well, that's we were pretty busy watching Entourage.
No time for other.
Any other 2009 music you want to highlight?
I didn't go through and do the same sort of list of things of like, oh, this stands out and this stands out. But I'm pretty sure that 2009 was the first ever time that I went to South by Southwest Music Festival. In Austin, mm-hmm. Texas.
And yeah, I've heard of it.
I remember being at, I think it was the Mohawk, which is one of the iconic venues in Austin, and seeing Mike Snow, and it was like
Sorry, is it actually pronounced Mike Snow?
You think it's pronounced Mike?
I
think it's
diet.
Generally pronounced Mike.
Okay.
But it was a debate at the time. I still don't know the answer, because I have not thought about them since this moment.
I still listen to those songs regularly.
Seeing that show was like, it felt like we were seeing the Beatles before they were about, like on Ed Sullivan. Like, that was how excited people were about that.
According to Wikipedia, it is pronounced Mike. I've been wrong about this the whole time.
They're named after a Japanese director, which is pronounced Mike, but the band is called Mike. I'm gonna say that I'm right on that. This is what I learned at South by Southwest in 2009. And I also was introduced in 2009 to Lone Star. So it was a pretty great year.
Contrary to suggestions or statements to the converse, the spelling of Mike does not derive from the Japanese film director Takashi Miike. We just liked it and added the extra I because we liked the look at it.
Okay. There we go. It was about white people trying to be cool. As with most things, there's no background to when white people try to be cool. They just did it. and also, Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix.
Yeah.
Like, those songs, still to this day, they're like pop rock hits. This was like U2 in their peak, what Phoenix was doing at that time. I mean, Listomania, 1901.
So a thing I did not know anything about until I was researching this as part of Let's Remember Some Years is that people did dance videos taking the dances from the movie The Breakfast Club and putting them to Listomania. And this was a big thing in 2009, including a group at Boston University that featured AOC.
Wow.
Oh, and that's why the Republicans hate her for that dancing. I remember that.
Yeah, that's definitely why the Republicans hate her.
They
got very mad about the dancing.
It's almost like Republicans were looking for something to be mad at her about.
I don't.
Otherwise, Republicans would have loved her. If only she hadn't danced. Oh my god.
Yeah, I watched those and then watched The Breakfast Club. It was a good week.
Did you actually?
I sure did. I feel like my takeaway from 2009, like, 2009 to me is the year that, like, and maybe this was just my perception, but it felt like the year that pop music, electronic music became pop music.
Definitely.
Like when you look at the success of the XX, Phoenix, Mike Snow, like all of those, among others, and then even just like the pop songs that were good featured more electronic elements that year.
And obviously has not changed to this day. Like all that music you're talking about, it was the start of it. Those artists could be equally as popular right now. I mean, the XX is still an extremely popular group. But like.
LaRue, also shout out LaRue.
It's definitely things that are like, it feels very familiar to the type of sort of electronic pop that we would listen to now. Okay.
What about, how top singles of the year, 2009?
Do you have a list of them?
What?
Do you have a list of them?
I do. I hope I'm reading this right, because you guys didn't mention these people at all, so I don't know. The Black Eyed Peas had two of the top five singles of the year.
I mean, it was a huge year for the Black Eyed Peas. I only put one of their songs on the playlist.
Boom, boom,
I put
Pow, and I Got a Feeling.
I Got a Feeling, yeah.
Also, did you mention it was a year of single ladies, really, truly? No?
Wait, that's not the right year, I don't think.
I swear I'm listening. Billboard year and Hot 100
singles. No, that came out in 2008.
It says it right here.
I mean, maybe it was still popular in 2010, but it came out in 2008. I'm sorry, in 2000. It was still popular in 2009, but it came out in 2008. So we talked about I Am Sasha Fierce last week.
Okay. All right. Fine. Well, on this list here. The song Knock You Down. You guys remember that? Or do you count that as 2008 too?
By who?
Carrie Hilson. And it had a Kanye West and Neo feature. You don't remember that song?
Man. This is 2009. I opted against putting it.
It was a jam.
I've got to go. I guess I'll do it now. I feel like I remember listening to that and being like, Kanye is on this. I need to listen to this. But
Kanye was on a lot of shit in 2009. He turned out.
When was the American Boy?
Oh yeah, Stell. Was that around this time?
I'm still not sure what you're asking about here.
You don't know
when Your American Boy
that
came out?
Out in 2008.
We missed that.
Man,
you don't know the song, Al?
I probably do. Oh, I probably do, but
still,
I don't know if I need to remember it.
Songs when you can just remember Kanye's verse because it's just, I don't know.
She just sold out all the floor seats.
Old Kanye.
I mean, he had also had a year, verse that year on Forever, which was a big one. Another Drake showcase.
Oh, right.
I mean, nothing to y'all.
And so far, Drake has had this shit forever.
I mean, really, both of them have, I would say, persisted quite well, considering that it's been over a decade. Just looking through really quick, I mean, the sort of, not the debut of Dirty Projectors as being like a major force in indie rock with Bitte Orca was a huge one in 2009. And then also the debut full length from, you talked about electronic music taking over, but Diplo finally reaching the masses in a huge way with Major Lazer. Is when Guns Don't Kill People, Lasers Do came out in 2009. It was like, I do agree with you that I feel like 2009 was when things, I mean, there still are like, you know, Vectimist by Grizzly Bear. There still are legendary dad rock records and indie rock records, but we're getting into the time period where those start fading to the background again. This almost was like, there was a period where I remember Jay-Z talking about, like, I like all music, I love indie rock, where Jay-Z was talking about how, like, he was influenced by Grizzly Bear. And every single year that started happening, less and less and less. And, you know, like the amount of times, if Bon Iver happens now, he's not in Hawaii recording with Kanye. But it was like things hit at the exact right time where these two worlds were able to exist, coincide with each other. And I feel like that just does not happen anymore. It's like the new Bon Iver's Rex Orange County or whatever.
Sure. I'll take your word for it.
But can we talk about Blame It by Jamie Foxx?
Absolutely we can. What do you have to say about Blame It? Did we miss Bon Iver in 2008? Did we miss Forever forever ago?
Maybe.
Wow. Okay. Maybe. How do you not care about this? I feel like you, of all people, should care about Bon Iver.
Eh.
Wow.
It's never really been my thing.
I'll tell you who Rex Orange County is later. Oh, my God. Okay, so I want to take a victory lap when it comes to... Or do you have more of the top 10 from that year to go over, Katie?
No, I didn't. My God.
Capital Block Party, 2009... Vera Project Stage. This was, I think I booked the entire lineup in 2008. 2009 definitely had like a little bit more of an ability to do whatever I wanted. And it was like looking back through the lineup, I was like, damn, this was a good lineup for the Vera Project Stage. This was only 2 days at the time. This was not 3 days of Capital Block Party. Are you interested to hear some of those bands played the Vera Project Stage Capital Block Party?
Do we have a choice?
I'll start with some of the smaller ones. Fences, who went on to international fame as being on a Macklemore song. Mika Levy, Mikachu and the Shapes. Mika Miko, the group who eventually turned into a band called Bleached, who are still a very popular band. Then we have successful Seattle rapper Saul.
Yep, I remember that.
Portland.
Friend of the podcast?
Friend, never been on the podcast, but friend of the pod.
Oh, 100%.
Portland's very own Starfucker. From Vancouver, BC, ended up the next year releasing huge album for dads. That is Japan Droids. They went opposite that year against Sonic Youth, which wasn't great for them. And also,
Japan Droids made the 2009 playlist with Young Hearts Spark Fire.
There you go. On the 2009 playlist. And then also the band who probably had maybe the biggest hit of any of the artists who played Capitol Block Party this year. But Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros.
Oh, yeah.
Played the Vera Project stage. You know, like Jesus Lizard and Sonic Youth played the main stage. But ultimately, Edward Sharp and Magnetic Zeros probably had a bigger song than any of them. I remember they rolled up in a tour bus, and the Vera Project, like, the parking was for a van. And it was like, they were like, so where do we park the bus? And I'm like, I don't know. We had to take over main stage parking so that Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros could park. And I, at the time, like, I barely knew who they were before. I think this was slightly before that Home song hit.
That was 2009, though. Wow, somehow I missed that.
And now it has 420 million plays on Spotify.
Because that's one of my favorites, so that definitely should have been in there. I screwed up.
Add it to the playlist.
It's on there now.
Oh, wow. We're doing this in real time.
Oh, it's a living living thing.
You couldn't even be bothered. You're adding these songs to the playlist right now. You couldn't even be bothered to go to the stage that your brother booked in 2009.
I don't know if I recall a specific offer.
Everybody
you mostly just wanted me to,
I was opening up the floodgates.
You mostly just wanted me to show up to drive you home at this point. Which I probably did in 2009.
Oh, man.
Just going to assume.
This wasn't the year where you and Chris drank.
No, that was last year. We discussed that on the podcast.
Right.
Were you there backstage, Katie, while we have you? We can talk about this later. When Nacho Picasso played?
Oh, again, not something I'm going to specifically remember unless there's some key element.
Okay, do you remember walking... So the Vera Project backstage was always pretty calm. Like, there's no alcohol back there.
Yeah.
Never really gets crazy. And it was... Like, there was, like, a hip-hop end to the stage. This might have been 2011 or 12. And Nacho Picasso was headlining. And Shad played before then. I think was on a Blue Scholar song at one point, Toronto rapper. And it was, like... the most people that I have ever seen backstage at the Vera Project stage. And I think it was you. I think it was you, me, Chris, and then maybe some other people, like, walked back, and I was like, oh my god, there are 50 people in this, like, 8x8 square foot area. And every single one of them was a cousin of Nacho Picasso's, where he was like, hey, can you let in my cousin over here? And I'm like, just anybody who you want, just tell them to come in. Don't find me when you need to find people, when you need to let people in. Just, and I think I told the person who was running production, I was like, look, if they stay there with Nacho Picasso, just let them in.
I have no recollection of this, but it's quite possible that I was there.
It was quite late on a Capitol Block Party night, so yeah. These recollections are always pretty hazy. But we were back there, and Macklemore walked in and was just like, oh my god, there's so many people here. And this is as described by Chris. Maybe we should have him on 2011. And Macklemore was like looking around being like, holy shit, there's so many people here. I have no idea. And Chris was like, he saw you, saw me, and then came over to me and was like, okay, I'm good. And I was like, that's maybe my greatest moment with fame in my entire life, that Macklemore was like, all right, I'm good to be here because Tristan is here.
I think I remembered if Macklemore came over and talked to... Did he talk to you? I don't know.
Yeah, he came over and was like, hey. And I was like, you're good. You're good to walk back here. And then everybody carried on.
Oh, I'd be curious to listen to next week's... 2 weeks from now? 3 weeks from now? Whatever.
You won't listen. It doesn't matter.
With Chris Smith to find out if I was actually there or not.
It's always good to find out about your own life. Yeah. All right, so who else was on the block party stage?
That was it as far as... That was pretty good for, like, 12 bands with a minuscule budget. Yeah. Some of them having, like, one of the biggest songs of the year. Like, Starfucker is still a relevant group. Japandroids became pretty huge. Saul's still doing stuff.
It was good work. Are you looking for an MVP award?
I think he is.
Capital Block Party 2009 MVP.
Oh my god.
You don't want it to yourself.
Just put it on a shirt.
The voting was unanimous.
I mailed it to you.
Bad news, I don't check my mail anymore. I'm too concerned. Okay. The risk is too high.
Oh god.
Alright.
Speaking of hip hop in 2009.
Bumbershoot.
I have so little recollection of Bumbershoot. I know that I went at some point, but when I look through the lineup, I'm just like, I know that, like, so Katy Perry headlined. This was after I Kissed a Girl. And then I think that was the only, like, larger hit that Katy Perry had at the time. There's Sheryl Crow. Mean,
hopefully it was a long time after you kissed a girl. But
what?
Did you hit the pot again?
Did you actually make your own drums there?
I did, yes.
No.
Speaking of hip-hop in 2009, on television, Community debuted.
That was your transition?
Where we learned of a person named Donald Glover for the first time ever.
That is true.
It was in 2009. I was sitting, Chris Smith and I were doing a fantasy football draft. I'm pretty sure this was the first year of Community. And he was like, hey, did you know that Troy from Community has a rap project? And I was like, no. And then he played me Childish Gambino for the first time ever. We were sitting there doing a fantasy football draft. And I won the league, of course. And he was rapping over, speaking of the mashups at the time, he was rapping over a Grizzly Bear beat and, like, didn't even turn down the vocals. Like, he didn't have the instrumental of it. He was rapping over Grizzly Bear with the vocals. This was how – and I remember just being like, wow, this dude is fucking awful at rapping.
He'll never make it. I remember being very excited about Community.
Oh, I mean, there's Dean Pelton, the most famous Pelton in TV history.
A character named Pelton. Also, Joel McHale, who we've been following since his time on the 1991 Huskies. Not really, but since he was on Almost Live. And obviously loving On the Soup. So we were pretty in on Community right away.
It was the most famous Pelton on TV since your extremely sweaty appearances on ESPN.
Oh, I had not been on ESPN by that point. I had only been, I don't think I'd even been on
I'm saying
NBC Sports
Northwest.
All-time
rankings. All-time TV rankings. Number one is Pelton TV rankings. Number one is Dean Pelton. Number two is you sweating on ESPN.
Wait. What about Kevin Peltonic?
Oh, actually, sorry, you're pushed down to number three. Number two is Kevin Peltonic.
Fair. That's fair.
From The Good Place, for those who
Number three is you awkwardly interviewing basketball players and looking at the wrong camera or whatever.
When was I looking at the wrong camera?
Didn't you do that during that, like, developmental league game that you did this year?
I mean, there wasn't multiple cameras to look at that point.
Or having to be told through your microphone to talk louder.
That definitely was true. The story you're thinking of is that I forget who, whether it was, yeah, it was Jonathan Motley, was like, which camera do I look at? And should I look at you or do I look at the camera? And I was like, I don't know. I've never done this before.
Are you name dropping Jonathan Motley now?
No, I am not name dropping Jonathan Motley.
You're like, yeah, I know J-Mott.
Explaining the level we're talking about here. Yeah.
I'm assuming this is a basketball player.
He is on a two-way contract with the Clippers.
Wow, I just dropped the Macklemore earlier. Get on my level, bro.
I'll find a place to name drop at some point here.
You guys are gross.
Do you want me to talk about how Wikipedia cites me for Brandon Roy's retirement?
Oh my god.
Does it really?
It does.
Do you have a Wikipedia page yet?
No, I do not. So, Community. 6 seasons. Experiencing a resurgence right now because it just arrived on Netflix. Gonna do a table read soon for charity.
I thought they already did that. What did they all get together for?
I'm not sure. They have not played the table read. I mean, It's going to be on NBC at some point, like the other show that debuted on NBC in 2009, Parks and Rec, which was in the spring because that was they did a short first season before a longer second season where they started to catch their stride. And they recently did a reunion episode during the pandemic. So a lot of lasting effect of the 2009 NBC comedies.
Katie, can I offer you a take about Parks and Rec from 2009?
That I had or that you had?
That I have right now.
Okay, go ahead.
3 words. Free Mark Brandanowitz.
Oh, Brandanowitz sucked. The show gets so much better the second he was off the show. And they brought in Rob Lowe and Adam Scott and really just went to the next level.
Do they let Brandanowitz be on the live stream?
He was not on there, no. Sadly, Della Shrimp did not make it either.
Wow.
By the way, speaking of... we'll get a crossover. We've got another TT that died. But a big year for Aziz Ansari because both Parks and Rec debuted and also... He's in the movie Funny People, but the only thing – I've never seen that movie. The only thing I know about that movie is the ad campaign that involved a series of YouTube videos with Aziz Ansari's character in that movie named Randy with 8 A's, which is the single funniest stand-up I have ever seen in my life. I stand by that.
You should maybe go back and watch that again.
Oh, it 100% holds up.
Randy with 8 A's was funny, but like – the single funniest stand-up you've ever seen in your entire life.
All right, that might be a slight exaggeration.
Did you guys vote to Aziz when he came to Seattle?
I've never seen him in person.
I think we were there together, weren't we?
Didn't he talk about, or were we, I can't remember if he talked about how he hated so much people calling out Randy or he made it part of his show. I can't remember.
I think he might have complained about it. Yeah. Where people kept yelling Randy at him, and he was just like, oh god, stop.
I would embrace it. It's great stuff.
Pretty sure people did yell at it at one of the shows, so we would, like...
No, probably not.
No?
No, you weren't there. Would you embrace it? Me and Katie were there.
That was an answer to would you embrace it. I would not actually embrace it.
Oh. I was like... He's the guy who makes jokes about Kanye saying he made 5 beats a day for 3 summers. God, stop talking about Randy, okay? More Kanye content.
2009 also saw the short-lived run of The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien.
Oh, right. And maybe that year or maybe some other year.
I went to 2010, but we'll count it here.
Conan O'Brien live show, which came to Spokane, Washington. It also came to Seattle, but I accidentally bought tickets for Spokane.
Wait, I didn't know this part of the story.
And so we drove down and met some friends of Ben's and went to the show. And I don't remember, it's a shocker here, much from the show. But I do remember there was a lot of guitar playing by Conan O'Brien at his live show. And
that was the legally prohibited from being funny on television tour.
That's right.
For Conan.
This must have been after, right? Because he did that when he was...
Right. I mean, the last episode of The Tonight Show was in 2010. That tour took place April to June 2010.
Sad, depressed, and played a lot of rock music.
Other movies in 2009, The Hangover... was a phenomenon. I remember going to see that at the old Renton Theater, RIP.
Did we go to that together?
I would assume so. It'd be very weird if we went to that separately. The other show, movie we were so excited to go see, it went to the very first night. This was in
Okay, I didn't see this in the notes, but yes.
Notorious. I still have a vivid memory of that night, including the fact that Jameer Nelson of the Orlando Magic got injured that night. Big effect on the NBA championship run, but definitely notorious first night in the theaters.
You remember that one, Katie? I think you were there.
I was there. I do not remember a thing about the movie. But I think we went
to Stanford's beforehand or something like that.
Stanford's? That I don't remember.
No, it probably wasn't Stanford's. It was the other place, but I can't remember what the other place was anymore.
The other place that was some shitty place that had a happy hour.
It's the place that's a buffet now. It's an Asian buffet now.
Did we go with your mom?
No, for I don't once, think we didn't go with Jan.
She was injured in the... I don't think she was interested in Notorious.
Notorious!
But she would have been interested in a happy hour.
That is true. She just may not have been invited to that part of it.
That movie. I've definitely not seen it since the time that we went and saw it on the first day. So it's been 11 years. But I just have like a vague memory of Puffy playing the like... the Mtume Juicy Fruit song, and then Biggie just being like, okay, I got it. it was basically the same as that Queen movie, where they're like, okay, it's gonna go like this, doom 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 doom, and then all of a sudden they're just like, here's a perfect song instantly after that, mixed and mastered in the studio, and you're like, okay, great, that's how music works. But that was the only scene that I remember is Puffy being like, this is going to be the track. And then it sounds immaculate right when Biggie is rapping it for the first time ever. So, that's how music gets made.
My main memory is of his interactions with Lil' Kim, who, it turns out, like I realized many years after the fact, is played by the woman from Power now.
Oh.
So, there you go.
Yeah, it all comes together.
I don't know if it does.
Okay, DJ All Youngin.
Anything else from 2009?
So, my wedding was in 2009.
That is correct.
Well.
There was a lot of Bruce Springsteen we danced to.
Did we?
Yeah.
We talked about the songs at the wedding a million times. But we weren't going to have a toast of any kind. I don't know why exactly, but our Uncle Paul, as you would pronounce it, our Uncle Paul had came through with like 40 bottles of mead that he made.
Oh, man.
Just cases of mead. And we were like, all right, fuck it. We pivoted in the moment and decided to do a toast with mead, which people drink like it's wine, but it's actually like has twice as much alcohol as wine. And is so sugary. I mean, it's basically champagne. And everybody was standing around in a circle, and I had a microphone for some reason. It was like, they should have never given me a microphone. And I remember there was like a lot of wooing and calling things out, and we drank so much mead.
Yeah. It was not a good choice in retrospect.
Oh, Katie's, I flew
Katie's
to Mexico.
Little brother in particular.
My poor little brother.
This was how old was Mughal?
not a bit.
not old enough to discuss on this podcast.
Okay, so but also that's a moment where he was like, God, people were wasted at that wedding. It was awesome. We had, I think we got 3 kegs and a lot of wine. I remember there was a Bud Light, I think it was Bud Light, Rainier, and Blue Moon were the kegs. And I went and picked them up in the morning, and then I gave them to Chris Smith, and I was like, take these kegs to the south side and have a party after, have an after party. And that's exactly what happened. And they took the wine from the wedding that was left over, which Jan had purchased.
Oh, dear.
And I'm pretty sure Jan rolled up to Christmas house, to Big John Nizzle's house in SeaTac to reclaim the wine because she was so upset. And I was like, take the wine, just go and have a party in SeaTac. It'll be excellent. And Jan was fierce. She like still was probably upset about this.
Oh, yeah.
If I bring it up to her.
100%. Yeah. And blames Chris and not you.
Oh my god. And I think they polished off the keg. Wait.
Oh, go ahead.
No.
I just want to know if you would still pick those same beers.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I mean, I would pick some of those same beers.
Which of those beers would you pick?
Rainier.
Oh, you had a Rainier. Okay.
If I were to curate three kegs again for a wedding, I would have Rainier and probably Johnny Utah, and then maybe I'd mix it up with like a San Juan Seltzer.
Oh, yeah. You wouldn't force a sour on everyone.
Oh, God.
I would have a Goza just for me. I'd be like, it's salty and sour.
That would be great if you just
drink up.
At all sours.
I wouldn't attend the wedding.
Oh, my God. I remember hearing a story about Reese, who came to the wedding, Third Pelton Brother Reese, and him saying that because he was living on Vashon with his parents at the time, and he was driving an old pickup truck, and him driving his old pickup truck after the wedding, and he had two giant bottles of wine. Because Jan doesn't buy normal-sized bottles of wine. She buys the large bottles of wine, because you got to look at it per ounce. You know what I'm saying? And him rolling up to a party on Vashon with, I think, two giant bottles of wine, being like, I've got wine. And showed up there after. I was like, that's the kind of energy that I want to have happen after my wedding. So I felt like it was a success.
Yes, it was very successful for you, but not for Michael.
Or Jan.
It wasn't Jan who lost her mind. It wasn't successful for me, who was hungover all the way to Mexico the next day.
So you guys actually did your honeymoon the old-fashioned way right after you left.
Oh, there are so many stupid things that we did that, again, I would not do now. Where I'm like, I won't be hungover after my wedding. It was like the flight left at like 7 a.m. the next day, too.
Oh, God.
It wasn't like it was a late flight. I was so stupid about so many things in 2009. Like, the process of just planning. I am so much better at planning for things now than I was then. Although I did book a flight out of Oakland when we were at the Count the Digs live show at like an insanely early time. I remember this was last year, so I don't know. No, I don't think yeah, there.
You join me.
There aren't that many flights out of Oakland. But I don't know why we decided to do that. That was a bad idea. But it was a great wedding.
Yeah, good wedding. Great wedding.
And I definitely was hungover literally until we got to, like, the hotel that we were staying at in Mazatlan. Anyway.
So 2009. If we head back to the present time, not a lot to discuss this week, obviously, but the Seahawks have a schedule for a hypothetical schedule for 2020. Assuming there's an NFL season, they are scheduled for four primetime games, hosting Sunday Night Football against New England in Week 2, Sunday Night Football against Minnesota in Week 5, Thursday Night Football against Arizona in Week 11, and then playing their one road primetime game, Monday Night Football at Philadelphia in Week 12. Another thing to note, obviously, with the schedule, they're playing the AFC East in the NFC East this year, which is not great for 10 a.m. starts. They've got four of them at Atlanta, Miami, Buffalo, and Washington. The schedule wraps up with the Seahawks traveling to face San Francisco in Week 17 after hosting the Niners in the NFC West showdown last year. Do you have any thoughts on the schedule?
It's all a mirage.
I was waiting for Katie's thoughts.
I mean, it's a good thought.
That's all. I'm not going to say anymore because it'd be too negative.
I mean, I think we have to approach it as if these games are going to happen. Because, you know.
What else are you going to do?
Yeah, pretty much. New England playing on Sunday Night Football on the road in week 2, I thought was pretty interesting. I mean, definitely a testament to New England as the institution being the thing that is drawing fans. I think they might have, and I have not analyzed New England's schedule or anything, but like they may have wanted to front load New England just a little bit to hedge their bets. Because,
yeah, just in case they fall off.
I mean, there's a chance. New England could be anywhere scheduled, you know, like best case and worst case scenario for them. It's such a large variation where it's like they should probably be on Sunday Night Football early. Because this could be a train wreck by week 12. You know, I guess they could flex it out. But I would say that the interest in the team will certainly be much higher in the first couple weeks of what we assume will be the Jared Stidham experience. And, you know, it could be great and they could be a thrilling team by season's end. Or it could be, you know, they could be just extremely bland. You know, they could be a 6-10 team, a 7-9 team. That's just not that exciting to watch.
Somehow they'll be good.
Oh, they'll probably be better.
Somehow.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're necessarily that front-loaded. Their next two national appearances are, this looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, week 9 and week 10 back-to-back. So, and then they play at the Rams on Thursday Night Football in week 14.
Wow.
So.
But it is like, you look at the schedule and you definitely see New England, you're like, that is interesting. I feel like, and maybe this is a byproduct of playing the AFC East, the schedule just doesn't look that tough.
Yeah, I mean, this was Third Pelton brother Ben Waldwin's point, is like, the schedule is pretty favorable, but all the other NFC West teams also have the same favorable schedule. So, you know, the challenge is to whether you can beat one of, you know, all of them to win the NFC West and have a real chance in the playoffs.
Well, so who are the extra games then? Are they Atlanta and Minnesota?
Correct.
Which aren't the easiest of extra games. You know, Minnesota could be the hardest team. They could be the best team in the NFC North. And then Atlanta's such a variable where it's like Atlanta every year could be anywhere between a playoff team to one of the worst teams in the NFL. So
it's good most teams.
But Atlanta in particular, it's like they were in the Super Bowl a couple of seasons ago, and then they had a top five pick shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
So
they're a team that's probably more dependent on staying healthy than almost any in the NFL.
But I don't know. We knew what these games were going to be. It's not a secret. Like, they weren't unveiling the teams to us. It's really just like, it's just the order in which the games might be played.
And then the national TV element.
So, I mean, you know, the Seahawks still get quite a bit of respect with regards to national TV games. And I just have to go out on a limb and say, nothing bad ever happens. I'm playing Thursday Night Football against the Cardinals.
Well, at least it's at home. It's not in Arizona. Really, historically, Sunday home games against Arizona have been the problem, not necessarily Thursday night. So I look forward to hopefully having some emergency podcasts, or maybe we'll just make up some fast emergency podcasts.
And maybe we'll have an actual emergency podcast. About real life emergencies and not football games.
So the question for the Seahawks with the 2020 season, beyond whether it gets played, is whether Jadeveon Clowney will be part of the team. Bad news in that regard, as we learned last week, that Bruce Irvin's cap hit is $5.9 million. an increase from the $3.8 million cap hit he had last year playing for the Panthers. That brings the Seahawks down to $16.1 million in cap space, according to OverTheCap.com, before signing their draft picks. So would need to do some shuffling, presumably, to fit in a Clowney deal.
Wait, are we not going to talk about the nudes?
I mean, I don't know what there is to talk about at this point.
I felt like a little bit alive for a part of a day, you know?
I feel like I missed it because I didn't know anything about this. So this is the story is that Reddit user, everyone loves nudes, nudes with a Z, correct?
Yeah.
Went on KJR because they had successfully predicted the Justin Britt release, and which was very difficult, and said that the Seahawks were going to trade for Myles Garrett from the Cleveland Browns. Today, I believe that trade was supposed to happen. And then later in the day, it revealed on Reddit that they were a Packers fan, and this was their long con in retaliation for the Fail Mary game.
Oh, man. The level of dedication.
The dedication is really towards using the word bamboozle. I have pulled off the bamboozle to end all bamboozles. And I will be inducted into the Bamboozle Hall of Fame.
Self-inducted into the Bamboozle Hall of Fame.
I mean, what happened to the 5-year waiting period for the Bamboozle Hall of Fame? I apologize for the bamboozles. This guy really, or woman, we don't know the gender. Women loves nudes too. loves that word bamboozle.
Oh my god. It was really fun. It was fun. I have to say.
Fun time.
Just you need something to get through the day, right?
Yeah.
Now.
It was like just a little bit of excitement.
Especially since you can't have the fun of listening to the Peltoncast, no. Apparently.
Yeah, you do fun things, Katie.
That's true.
You were bamboozled.
I would never describe reading Reddit as a fun thing.
Oh, it's from Twitter. I got linked to it.
Yeah, Twitter. You don't read Reddit itself. God, nobody would go to Seahawks Reddit. You wait for a story to become interesting enough on Seahawks Reddit to be elevated to Twitter.
But it was fun.
It's quite a bamboozle. This was great. I mean, this was what we talked about last week when the Seahawks were talking about bringing back Marshawn Lynch, which it feels like Pete Carroll shut down pretty quickly. But, like,
it lost a lot of steam in a hurry.
Maybe we were bamboozled by Pete.
Oh. I think we were I don't know. Maybe it was Marshawn's agent who did the bamboozling. Were we the bamboozler or the bamboozy?
Boozily?
I just love the idea of being through everything that has happened with Seahawks Packers, like them losing a game that would have sent them to the Super Bowl in insane, unexpected fashion, but still to this day being like the Fail Mary. That's what caused everything. That's what they're upset about. And even though the Packers beat the Seahawks in the playoffs this year, and they're like, I still need to pull off a bamboozle. This wasn't a Ben Baldwin, Aaron Rodgers thing. This was just the Fail Mary. That's my favorite part about it.
It is the best part, yeah.
It's like us with the Steelers. Like, the Steelers don't think about how we were bamboozled in Super Bowl 40, but, like, that's only a Seahawks issue. So if we were to pull off a long con against the Steelers, it would be in retaliation for Super Bowl 40, and they'd be like, it's for what now? So much has happened to them in the meantime while we were over here thinking about Super Bowl 40. And I think that's the same thing that happened to the Packers.
Well, we got to start thinking of some bamboozles.
Maybe just that one guy. I don't know.
I think they're representative of the whole fan base. Oh, but I was saying with the Marshawn Lynch thing, is like, we're paying attention to this because it's fun. And really, ultimately, like, this was fun. And that's all that matters.
Yep.
But
hopefully this podcast was also fun.
Oh, well, I want to say, I do have the receipts to prove this. I called bullshit immediately when we heard Myles Garrett's name. I was like,
that is true.
I was willing to suspend belief that everyone loves nudes might have some intel. I also just love the idea, and that KJR is just like, sure, that if you get one player being released correct, all of a sudden you're Woj or Shams.
Do you know how desperate they are for content right now?
I think KJR definitely wins the situation. Like, their credibility is not an issue right now. They just need anybody to tune in, and I feel like they made national news for a little period of time. So, but yeah, that's my other favorite part about it, is just how little it takes to become a credible source is predicting that Justin Britt would be released when everybody knew Justin Britt would be released. And then all of a sudden you're such a credible source that you're on the radio talking about a made-up trade. I love everything about it.
So, well, there you go. Kevin did not love everything about it.
He hates nudes.
I feel like I missed out on this whole experience. I just read back through your G-chat. I really was not paying attention.
Look, those lawns aren't going to mow themselves.
Were you doing yard work? Tell the truth.
I was... when Tristan and I talked about it, I was mowing the lawn. I think I had spent 2 hours trying to replace the starter cable on the lawnmower. It requires a lot more dexterity than I have.
On that note...
thanks so much to... We knew it would happen. The reigning MVP. I guess we will find out... next year, if she's able to pull an MJ and have a three-peat as the Peltoncast MVP. Thank you, Katie, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It is truly an honor.
Sure sounds like it. hopefully we can have you back for another segment to tell you about some years, to remember some moments that you were a part of for you. And yeah. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Thank you.
What did you do after I hung up?
I mean, I tried to pause for a bit because I didn't know how long you were going to be gone. Then I had to continue going.
It was very awkward.
So good. I was like, I'm just going to hang up and have it be really weird for them.
It's like, I know these are things that Tristan is going to want to participate in and talk about, so I don't want to do them without him, but eventually I have to do something.
Really, what I came back to was so strange. Oh, man. All right. Well, I feel like that was pretty good content.
I think so, too.
All right.
All right. Thank you, Katie.
I will see you guys later.
You won't.
Oh, that's right. I never will. Okay.
We'll talk on G-Chat later.
We'll see you on the
on Jackbox.
On Jackbox on Saturday. Yeah. We'll see you then.
I'll see you. All right. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.